It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Changing of the Guard in India. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. India's opposition party, Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, has won a resounding mandate in the country's general election, capturing a majority on its own of more than 280 of the 543 seats in the lower house of parliament. The outcome, after a six-week marathon election, marks a historic loss for India's original political party, Congress, which captured fewer than 50 seats, and brings into question the future of the Gandhi family dynasty. What is certain is that the world's largest democracy will have a new prime minister able to form a government without relying on regional coalition partners. That incoming prime minister is none other than Narendra Modi, formerly chief minister of the western state of Gujarat. Modi ran a vigorous and highly professional nationwide campaign that captivated the youth and others fed up with high inflation, slowing growth, and corruption. In contrast to his political rivals in the Nehru-Gandhi dynasty, which has ruled India for the last 10 years, Modi has a modest upbringing. His father worked as a railway station tea vendor, and his mother served as a domestic helper. However, at a young age, Modi joined a right-wing Hindu nationalist organization, and controversy has swirled around him since 2002, when Hindu-Muslim rioting in his Gujarat state killed more than 1,000 people. But India's Supreme Court cleared Modi of charges he incited violence. In any case, many analysts say that these elections are likely to have important consequences for the world's largest democracy, for its global position, and consequently for the international community. Well, for more on the domestic, regional, and global implications of the Indian election, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Lisa Curtis is a senior research fellow at the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. That's a Washington-based policy group, and Michael Kugelman. He's Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. That's a think tank also based in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Lisa Curtis, let me begin with you. So does the BJP and Narendra Modi's victory, in your view, signal a decisive shift in Indian politics? And if so, why?
I think so. It's quite remarkable that the BJP has won a majority of seats. This is the first Indian political party to do so in 30 years. So I think it shows that people were tired of the Congress party, the malaise that had set in with that government, the sense that the Congress government was out of touch with people's concerns, whether it be corruption, slowing economic growth. And I think Narendra Modi was really able to connect with the youth population of India, which is ironic because Rahul Gandhi of the Congress party, of course, is a young leader, but he was a disappointment. He just was not able to connect with the people in the same way that Modi was able to. So I think it does bring a change. And I think there'll be some opportunities for the U.S. with this new BJP government, but there may also be some challenges as well. And with regard to opportunities, I would say because they're likely to have a more decisive, robust foreign policy, this may open opportunities for defense cooperation, cooperation in the Asia Pacific. When I talk about challenges, I'm referring to the fact that we may see increased tensions between India and Pakistan because, of course, as you mentioned, Narendra Modi has a somewhat controversial past. Some perceive him as being anti-Muslim and very hardline. So I think we'll have to see what happens. But I think from the U.S. perspective, we're going to have to be on our toes and watching very carefully to ensure that Indo-Pakistani tensions don't escalate.
We'll get into all the implications of your answer, Lisa, in just a moment, but let me turn now to Michael Kugelman to get your view, Michael, of the landslide victory. What factors contributed, in your view, to this
incredible victory and defeat for a Congress party.
Well, essentially, the majority of Indians just concluded that the Congress party no longer represented what India should be. Not only was it so unpopular, it was seen as the party that presided over the collapse of the Indian economic miracle, and also it had gotten caught up in so many corruption scandals that involve so much money, billions and billions and billions of dollars. So there was that. And I think that people were just ready, particularly the young people, but people across the board, particularly those in urban areas, that increasingly can understand that this Congress party model of emphasizing social welfare policies, subsidies, that type of thing, that in of itself cannot be a sustainable policy in terms of economic governance. And the BJP, and specifically Modi, brings a whole other way of looking at this issue. He's much more focused on market solutions, and he certainly has had a great measures of success in Gujarat, in the state where he's been chief minister for a number of years. One couldn't say that there were economic miracles there, as he oftentimes depicts his accomplishments there. But essentially, Indians have concluded that it's time for something new. And I think so keen were they on having a change that they were willing to overlook, including some Muslims, I believe, overlook Modi's baggage, which is significant.
We'll talk about that baggage. But first, if in fact this was a vote against the Congress party and for a new economic strategy, what does it mean for the Congress party? How will they regroup?
I think that they're going to have to reassess their leadership because, as I was saying, Rahul Gandhi was a major disappointment. So I think that they will have to think about how they move forward and with what leadership. They have to find policies that connect better with the youth of the country. And as Michael was saying, perhaps reconsider their economic policies. Really, the Congress started falling apart during its second term. And this was largely because Prime Minister Manmohan Singh did not seem to bring the same energy to the position that he did in his first term. And whether this is health issues or something else, it's not entirely clear. But I think what happened is when the corruption scandals did break, that the Congress leadership just did not handle them correctly. Congress definitely bears responsibility for its loss of popular support. But at the same time, we're seeing tectonic shifts among the Indian population. And because of social media, because people are moving into the middle class, India is becoming part of the global economy. Because a lot of these shifts in the polity, I think the Congress party just simply wasn't able to keep pace with the social changes that were happening. And the BJP, on the other hand, had a very tight campaign. Modi was very active on Facebook and Twitter. So the BJP just understood how to connect with those younger voters.
Back to you, Michael Kugelman, briefly to comment on what you think this loss means for the future of the left-of-center Congress party.
Parties like Congress, which are dynastic, dominated by political families, they don't go away easily. So it's not going to be disappearing anytime soon. But I think it's certainly going to need to retrench and really think about its future. And then policy shifts will be a necessity. But I would emphasize, and Lisa hit on this, not just policy changes, but also just it needs to change its general attitude and how it regards India and Indians.
Back to you, Lisa Curtis. Let's take a look at how Narendra Modi and the BJP will be leading the country. We talked about his controversial background as a Hindu nationalist and his actions vis-a-vis the Muslim community in Gujarat. And we note, too, that this parliament has the fewest Muslim members since the early 1950s. Talk about the kinds of reforms he campaigned on and how you see the implementation of these economic reforms and to what extent this controversy based on his Hindu nationalist background will play out.
I think it was clear that he tried to distance himself from communal politics during the campaigning. When other BJP leaders, for instance, the leader of the state of Bihar wing of the BJP, made a very controversial statement. He said something like, if you don't like Modi or the BJP, you can go to Pakistan, you know, something very, very insensitive. Modi immediately tweeted, distancing himself from the statement. So he clearly moved away from communal politics. He recognized that he had some work to do in repairing his reputation and that he did take steps to move in that direction. He focused on the economy and good governance, really a laser-like focus on these issues. It's also worth noting that, of course, the BJP, the three main planks that they have followed have been to do away with the Uniform Civil Code, which would basically take away Muslims' rights to practice certain special family laws. So that's one controversial policy that in the past the BJP has pursued. And of course, the other major issue is rebuilding the Ram Temple at the site of Ayodhya, where a mosque was destroyed by Hindu zealots in 1992. This is an extremely controversial issue. And the third issue is to take away the autonomous status that is granted to the state of Jammu and Kashmir through the Indian Constitution. So these are three issues that the Muslim community would find very controversial in India. But I think it's worth noting that even though these policies are in their manifesto, that during their last reign in power from 1998 to 2004, the BJP did not pursue these policies. They were focused on other things, building relations with the U.S., moving the economy forward. So I think we can expect that this time around. I don't see the Modi government focusing on the Hindutva agenda, the Hindu nationalist agenda. I think simply the mandate was to move forward on the economy, improve governance, and, you know, reassert India's role on the world stage.
Before we go to a break, Michael Kugelman, your feedback with regard to Modi's agenda. He will be focusing, do you think, on this economic agenda, reform, fighting corruption, and much less so on the, you know, Hindu nationalist plank of the BJP?
Everyone is asking the question, which Modi are we going to get? Are we going to get the hardline Hindu nationalist Modi, the one who's been associated with all these hardline causes and has associations with all these very disturbing groups? Or are we going to get Modi, the pragmatic economic reformer who did all these impressive things in Gujarat? And I would agree with Lisa. I think at least initially, Modi knows that he was elected with a nearly unprecedented mandate to repair India's economy. And this is what he does best. This is his strength. He's built a great reputation over the years for being a great economic reformer and leader. So I think that that's exactly what we're going to see. That said, it will be very difficult for him to replicate on a national scale what he did in one state. And as you know, India is an enormous country. It's a very complicated country. And so it's one thing to have these successes in Gujarat. It's something else to do them everywhere. And also, you know, I said initially he'll be focusing on economics, pragmatic stuff. But let's face it, once India is provoked, and by that I mean if there's a terrorist attack in India, traced back to Pakistan, or if China engages in any sort of incursion into disputed areas, if something like that happens, then I think all bets could be off in terms of what he could do, and he could then perhaps resort or be more willing to cater to this hardline wing of the party, the one that wants to continue to focus on the Hindu nationalist agenda.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Lisa Curtis, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center, and Michael Kugelman, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and that's a think tank also based here in Washington. We're talking about the sea change in India's government as a result of the BJP's landslide victory in India's recent national election, which has catapulted Narendra Modi to the post of Prime Minister. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And here's a shout-out to a loyal listener, Chris Addison, an Englishman based in the Netherlands, who listens to the show via podcast. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email with feedback to encounter@voanews.com. Well, back to you, Lisa Curtis, and let's explore the implications of the victory of BJP and Narendra Modi for regional relations, particularly with Pakistan. And we note that Modi invited Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif to attend the swearing-in ceremony Monday, along with other neighbors. This is apparently an unprecedented move. What do you make of this gesture, and will the change in New Delhi lead, in your view, to improved or worsening relations, perhaps, between the two nuclear rivals?
Well, I think this was an unprecedented gesture, inviting their prime ministers from South Asia, including Pakistan's leader Nawaz Sharif, to the swearing-in ceremony. And I think this showed that he wants to try to get relations off to a good start with Pakistan. He has walked a very fine line during the campaigning. He has made clear that he is open to building economic ties with Pakistan, but he's also been pretty clear that Pakistan must ensure that its territory is not used to launch terrorist strikes against India. But I think in general, we need to be prepared for the increased possibility of tensions in India-Pakistan relations. Manmohan Singh was extremely patient with Pakistan. He showed a great deal of forbearance. I think his calculation was that since Pakistan was so unstable, he was willing to give the civilian leadership the benefit of the doubt and seek to engage with them despite, you know, the fact that terrorist attacks were occurring in India, the most notable being the 2008 Mumbai attacks. I don't think we're going to see that same level of patience. Modi doesn't have the same disposition as Manmohan Singh. And frankly, the party spent a lot of time criticizing the Congress government for being too soft on Pakistan. So, as Michael said, if we, God forbid, have some kind of major attack in India, I think we're going to see a tougher response from a BJP government than we would have expected to see under Congress. But, you know, I would say that Modi is not looking to pick a fight with Pakistan. And I think Nawaz Sharif, his personal inclination would be to engage in dialogue. But the fact is, you've got the Pakistan military, and Nawaz Sharif will have to watch his back. He'll have to ensure that the military backs him in anything he does with India. He's learned the hard way that he certainly can't not defy the Pakistan military. And so in terms of the Pakistan military's calculations, it's unclear whether they are interested in having Pakistan engage a BJP government or not.
Turning to you, Michael Kugelman, how do you see relations between India and Pakistan going forward under Narendra Modi, notwithstanding this very unprecedented, one might say magnanimous gesture of inviting Nawaz Sharif to the swearing-in ceremony? Do you foresee increased tensions, potentially, as Lisa suggested, may occur?
Yeah, unfortunately I do. Modi is really a wild card for India-Pakistan relations. We really don't know what's going to happen. Certainly, as Lisa said, Modi is definitely interested in economic diplomacy and wanting to get things right with Pakistan, focusing on commercial trade angles.
Okay.
India and Pakistan for years have been talking about formalizing their trade relationship into a most favored nation status type arrangement. It hasn't happened, and Modi is the type of leader that one would expect would want to inject momentum into that process. This is something that the Pakistani security establishment has been holding back on. But in that regard, there's reason to be hopeful. But, you know, people forget that among the various things Modi said on the campaign trail about Pakistan, he said a lot of nice things about wanting to focus on partnership, etc. But he also made a threat at one point to go into Pakistan and try to apprehend or locate a very heavily wanted Indian gang member, criminal, Dawood Ibrahim. So that certainly it would not go down well in Pakistan. You know, I think we need to acknowledge that the Pakistani security establishment has traditionally sided with militant elements that have gone after India, Indians in Afghanistan. And I fear that with someone like Modi now in power, who's seen across the board by people in Pakistan, even among many liberal progressive Pakistanis, as someone who's anti-Muslim and is very unhappy with the idea of Pakistan, I fear that the Pakistani security establishment would be more likely to continue to side with these anti-India militant forces.
Back to you, Lisa Curtis. Of course, we note that heavily armed gunmen opened fire on the Indian consulate in western Afghanistan Friday. So this brings Afghanistan and Afghanistan's very strong relationship with India into play and how that might continue to irritate Pakistan. How do you see the Indian-Afghanistan relationship going forward? Will it be as robust and strong as it has been under the Congress party with Karzai and now Karzai's successor, whoever that might be, with Modi?
Well, I would say, yeah, this attack on the Indian consulate that just happened, you know, I think this is a real test for Modi. And it's not just Modi. I think the BJP, there are many members, there are advisors who would like to adopt a more assertive foreign policy. And with regard to Afghanistan, this means continued assistance to the Afghan government, continued engagement, continued support for the government for training the Afghan security forces. Of course, India has stopped short of providing direct military assistance, but India did announce that it would basically provide money to Russia for Russia to provide arms to Afghanistan. So even there, we're seeing a more assertive policy toward Afghanistan. And frankly, if the intent by this attack is to sort of scare India away or make India think twice about its engagement with Afghanistan, I don't think it's going to work under a BJP government. So, you know, I think, unfortunately, as I said, we're probably entering more tensions between India and Pakistan than we have seen in the last, you know, 8-9 years. I think things have been relatively calm over the last 8 or 9 years, but I think we're probably entering a period where the region will be on tenterhooks once again. But I think this attack on the consulate is an early test of Modi and how he's going to move forward with Afghanistan.
And Michael Kugelman, briefly, would you agree that we'll be seeing an equally, if not more, assertive policy from the Modi government vis-a-vis Afghanistan, notwithstanding Pakistan's dissatisfaction, you know, with Indian-Afghan relations growing and becoming stronger?
Yes, I do, though only to a point. I mean, the Indians and the Afghans have a strategic agreement that's been in place for a few years that obliges India to provide economic assistance, training, advising to the Afghan military. So that will continue. And I do think that Modi will want to perhaps even intensify those efforts. But at the same time, yes, it's true that Modi would not be as restrained as the last Indian government in terms of how large of a presence and how much it does in Afghanistan, though I don't know if Modi would go so far as to try to intensify its military assistance, because at the end of the day, Modi is a nationalist in the positive sense, and that he does not want to put Indians at harm. And certainly in Afghanistan, you know, we had this attack on the Indian consulate in Herat, but before that, Indians have been hit again and again and again in Afghanistan. Their embassy was hit twice. The consulate in Jalalabad was hit not too long ago, and private Indian citizens have been targeted at guest houses in Afghanistan as well. So Modi would not want to go so far that the lives of Indians are at even more risk than they already are in Afghanistan.
And as we conclude, a very big question, and back to you, Lisa, that is the U.S.-Indian relationship. How might they change U.S.-Indian ties, and to what extent will India still represent, as it has been, some sort of a counterweight to China? And of course, U.S.-China relations are increasingly tense with the cyber crimes and South and East China Sea tensions. How do you see the Indian-U.S. relationship in all of that?
Well, I think there is a fresh opportunity for the U.S. and India to reinvigorate the relationship. It had certainly fallen into a state of malaise under the second Singh government with the lagging economic growth and, you know, the fact that the Singh government was focused on the domestic situation, the corruption scandals. I think the U.S.-India relationship had really languished. So I think with a new government, there is an opportunity to move forward. But first, the Obama administration is going to have to reach out and assure Modi that it's not going to give him the cold shoulder over the 2002 Gujarat riots issue, because we have this whole issue where his visa was revoked in 2005 because of his perceived role in not doing enough to stop that rioting. So, you know, as long as the U.S. makes clear that it wants to engage with Modi and it's willing to move forward, not dwell on the past, I think we'll see the BJP reciprocate and there will be opportunities to move forward. Because if we have a BJP government that is pursuing a more robust foreign policy, which means it's willing to take steps to mitigate risk to India's national security, I think you'll see some real convergence between the U.S. and India, particularly on defense cooperation, hedging against China's rise. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that Modi's going to come in and try to pick a fight with China. I think he wants to engage with China economically. But I also think that he'll be tougher when it comes to potential provocations by China along their border. So there may be a more willingness from the BJP to coordinate with the U.S. on its Asia pivot strategy.
Very good. And we do note that President Obama phoned the new Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, Friday and did invite him to visit Washington. So that's a good sign.
Yeah, that's a very good sign, positive step. And I think it was the right thing for President Obama to do. So, you know, let's see what happens.
And the last word to you, Michael Kugelman, India-U.S. relations and their implications for geopolitics on the global level vis-a-vis China and the region.
U.S.-India relations have been in a lot of trouble lately, as Lisa suggested, and Obama certainly did the right thing by right away telling Modi what we all knew he was going to tell him eventually, and that's that Modi is welcome to come to the United States. There's some short-term and long-term considerations here. In terms of the short-term, the U.S. will definitely need to launch a charm offensive, if you will, if it wants to ensure that it'll have Modi in its corner. I think it would be a good idea to send some sort of senior-level U.S. delegation to New Delhi on the soon side to meet with Modi. I think it's really important to appoint a new ambassador to India. The U.S. ambassador resigned in May. So I think if the U.S. wants to suggest that it takes the relationship with India seriously, it needs to have an ambassador in place. Long term, both countries have suggested that the other has protectionist policies that make it hard to trade with the other. And Modi, I think, is a good person to try to, you know, get down and work with U.S. leadership on dealing with that issue. So the U.S.-India relationship will never be a perfect relationship. I think in some ways it's been a bit oversold over the years. But Modi, I think, is a good person and offers a fresh start for U.S.-India relations.
And of course, we have a large Indian-American community here in the United States, and I assume that they will continue to play an important role in that relationship. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. We'll be closely monitoring Indian politics, its impact on the region and U.S.-Indian relations in the weeks and months to come. I'd like to thank my guests, Lisa Curtis. She's Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center, and Michael Kugelman, Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thanks to both of you for coming in and sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.